Welcome to Nightlife, a bite-size episode.
If you sometimes feel that we're incapable these days of having rational, well-informed debates about big issues and working out well-thought-out solutions to problems, then you're definitely not alone. We're constantly hearing the level of confidence in our leaders and in politics in general has been vastly diminished in recent years, as levels of polarisation in politics and public life have increased. Environmental issues in particular have been the fodder for plenty of name-calling and argument and controversy, with huge debates over coal mining, the Adani mine, for example, climate change, renewable energy, even the question of whether climate change is real, despite the world's scientists telling us that it most certainly is. Our next guest has watched these debates unfold in North America, where political polarisation is even worse, and he spent a lot of time thinking about how to improve the state of public debate. James Hogan is the author of I'm Right and You're an Idiot. He's a Canadian public relations professional. He's also founded a website focusing on exposing misinformation about environmental issues. He's been in Australia addressing the question of, is being right enough? He joins us on Nightlife. James, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Well, thanks for having me.
Your interest in this question of what to do about the state of public debate on the environment was inspired by David Suzuki, the famous Canadian environmentalist. Tell us about a conversation you had with him in Montreal about 10 years ago.
Yeah, it was our first board meeting. I was invited on to the board of the David Suzuki Foundation, and we were talking about environmental issues, and he was basically saying, you know, how is it possible with all this scientific evidence about the environmental crises, not just climate change, but other issues, extinction of species, what we're doing to our oceans. I mean, the science is overwhelming. And, you know, why is it that in spite of all this science, we're doing so little to fix these problems? And I remember it kind of stuck with me. You know, it was such a good question that, you know, why are we listening to each other shout instead of what the evidence is trying to tell us is a really good question. Mm. You know, why do we, and it, you know, the more I thought about it.
So you didn't have an answer for it?
No, I had no answer. And it was kind of embarrassing because I'd actually been asked onto the board because I'm considered a communications expert. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it seems to me that that's a pretty sensible kind of question to ask of someone who's a communications expert. I think it sort of led me down this road of starting to investigate it and talk to people who are expert in this area and eventually to write this book.
Mm. You set out to cut through some of that misinformation around the climate debate. You wrote a book in 2009 called Climate Cover-Up. But you still found that even though you'd laid out pretty clear evidence of deception on the issue, that people didn't seem that outraged. Why do you think they weren't?
Well, I think it's because we have... when I first started it, I thought, you know, being a PR person, I thought it was about misinformation. Mm. So I thought it was, you know, people were just being misinformed and that there were some dark organizations that were basically out to protect their interests by misinforming the people about science. And I realized as time went on that I was actually wrong about that, that really what was being done was more kind of a, not a misinforming, there's some of that, but it was more a polarizing. And when you divide people into teams, open-minded thinking shuts down. Mm. One of the guys I interviewed for my book was a fellow named Jonathan Haidt. And he said, you know, human beings are designed by evolution to divide up into teams, to unite against other teams, and to become blinded to the truth because of that process. And that, I think, is this problem that's created this kind of warlike approach to public disagreement and this unyielding one-sidedness in public discourse, not just about the environment, but
It seems to have got worse, I must say. How much of it do you think is a left-right thing that the environment and renewable energy, care for the Great Barrier Reef, et cetera, is seen by some as a left political issue, and that's not a place they want to be because they consider themselves to be somewhere else on the political spectrum. In other words, that there are issues which, rightly or wrongly, are seen as left political issues, and there are other issues, rightly or wrongly, that are seen as conservative political issues. And people identify with one of those two sides.
Yeah. Yeah, no, and I think it's a good question. I mean, I am a corporate public relations person. I'm not really an environmentalist. So, you know, I've represented Shell. I've represented oil companies and mining companies. And so I'm not particularly left or particularly right. But I do understand that these environmental issues we're facing are fairly serious. I have a hard time believing that just because you're a conservative, you don't care about, you know, the increase in childhood asthma, or that you're not concerned about the quality of water.
You might care about it, but you believe that the proposals being offered to you to do things about it,
yes,
are coming essentially from the left, and not from the right. So, for example, proposals to increase welfare spending, for example, to do something about homelessness. If you're coming from the right, you might think, well, that's not how I would see it. I would see a reassertion of family values, for example, and the role of the family as being a much better way to address those issues. Now,
yes,
there's legitimacy to those arguments. In other words, it's not the problems. I think both sides agree there are problems. It's the solutions that create the divide.
That's right. But I think that once you start to tribalize things and you basically massage tribal meaning into science, then you start to see things through a different lens. And so, you know, something like climate change should not be a left-right issue.
No.
The biggest factor in North America.
But it is, though.
It absolutely is. But that is, I think, partly because of people like me in the public relations business convincing people that this isn't something that people like us believe in, and if you do believe this, you can't be one of us. You must be one of them. That is a public relations technique that is more pervasive and more problematic than misinformation. It's a type of propaganda that kind of tribalizes evidence. And it's basically, I think, kind of a war on objectivity.
Yeah, we saw in recent years in the United States, I mean, some spectacular examples of this, didn't we? I mean, the birther movement, for example, around President Barack Obama, this idea that he wasn't a U.S. citizen, for example, because he wasn't born in the United States, a simple matter which was easily proved or disproved one way or the other. It didn't matter to a lot of people because they just persisted on with this assertion that he wasn't an American citizen in the face of all evidence, and to a large extent won some of the debate. That is, people believe this.
Right.
How can that happen?
Because it's not really a rational debate. It's a fight.
Yeah.
And you have to, if you've decided whose side you're on, winning the fight is the issue. It's not it's not a rational kind of thought process. So facts actually don't do very well in fights with emotions. And the kind of emotional power that comes with your tribe, you know, people. You know, so say you're a Republican living in the Midwest, you're a barber, and you decide, you know, maybe your son or your daughter goes to university and comes home and starts talking to you about climate change, and you start to think, wow, this actually seems like it's a real problem. The forces that are working against you starting to talk about that in your barber shop are both community and economic. So the forces are that drive people to conform to the cultural beliefs of the group that they belong to are more powerful than science. They're more powerful than facts. They're more powerful than reason.
Was it always the case? I mean, ever since the mid-19th century, when Charles Darwin proposed his theory of evolution, this argument went up against seemingly immovable forces like, you know, the traditional established churches, for example, and indeed the entirety of Christian belief. And that argument's continued to this day. There are still people, a large number of people, particularly in North America, who don't accept it. In other words, has it always been the case, or do you think that the non-acceptance of scientific facts these days is worse than ever?
I think it always has. There has been some of that. You know, since the public relations industry started in, you know, 1930, somewhere around 1930, there has been an enormous growth in social science. So we know a lot more about the biases and the heuristics and the attitudes that people bring to decisions that they make and opinions that they form. And that information or that science is basically being used by communications people to nudge people into these kind of warring tribes. Mm. And so once you sort of, once you join the team, open-minded thinking towards the other team shuts down.
Do you think there's too much debate and not enough dialogue?
Yes.
In other words, we are too intent on winning the debate and proving that we are right and you're wrong, and that we're not keen enough on simply having a discussion about
this. Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think one of the greatest realizations that people could, that any one of us could have, is that we could be wrong. That
we hate that, don't we? All of us.
Yeah, we do. But one of the guys I interviewed for my book, a guy named Jason Stanley, said, important to keep in mind that you too could unknowingly be under the influence of bias, unconsciously under the influence of bias. There was another woman, Carol Tavris, who wrote a book called Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. And she said, we should hold our beliefs lightly, because if evidence comes along to show us that we're wrong about something, if we hold them lightly enough, we'll be able to let go of them without feeling like we're a fool.
People don't like to do that, though, do they?
No,
because people acquire a set of beliefs, and that governs their life, and that gives them certainty, and that's how they like.
Yeah, and what I've come to believe is that, just like you can pollute the natural environment, you can pollute public conversations. And just like we have a responsibility to the public good of a healthy environment, we have a responsibility to the public good of a public square where facts actually matter. And so I think whether you're on the right side of the issue or on the wrong side of the issue, civility, open-mindedness, and just keeping in mind that other people have different values and different opinions, and part of the process of democracy is actually being open to the dialogue, even with people that you don't agree with and don't particularly like.
Yeah, I do worry that it's getting worse. We've got an administration in the US, the Trump administration, which openly trumpets and boasts about the fact that he doesn't accept facts. It calls them fake news.
And lies constantly.
And also offers what they call alternate facts.
Right.
In other words, the public discourse seems to have got worse.
Yes.
Do you think?
Absolutely. And I think he's a bit of a different case because he's so blatant about it. But I think that has been going on for some time. When you think about it, just that having a situation where you can dismiss science as being liberal. Like, what does that even mean?
Well, I think I know what they, I think I have a sense of what they mean. They mean that it offers a set of solutions to problems which come from the left, and we don't want that.
Well, I mean, I don't think climate change is,
Want to shut down coal mines. Now, I don't want to shut down coal mines.
Right. Well, yeah, that's a different conversation. I mean, I think that, the fact that people have to work.
That's right.
That we need an economy.
That's right.
At the same time that we're digging this stuff out of the ground that's overheating our climate. That's a very, very serious systems problem.
No, I understand the facts behind all of this, but
right.
I think many people on the other side of the argument, I'm right and you're an idiot, think, well, yeah, that may be the case, but this is not the correct way to go about doing it. There must be a better way of doing it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't pretend to have all the answers to this, but if you can't even actually have a conversation about this with somebody you disagree with, when I was doing one of the interviews for my book was with this Vietnamese monk named Thich Nhat Hanh, and David Suzuki and I were sitting on this stage with him along with the mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, And he was he said, you know, you don't need to tell people they're destroying the planet. You need to deal with the despair. They know that they're destroying the planet.
Yeah.
And so I said to him, you're not saying that David Suzuki shouldn't be an activist, are you? And he looked at me and he said, speak the truth, but not to punish. Speak the truth, but not to punish. And I remember thinking, like, it felt like somebody had kind of punched me in the solar plexus, because I thought, you know, so much of what we do when we have strong feelings and we have concerns about things that we should be concerned about is that we forget that somebody else on the other side may have a completely different view, and they may be a totally good person. They just have it wrong.
Mm. And telling them they're an idiot doesn't win you the day.
No, or thinking that they are and treating them that way in subtle ways doesn't help, because people get the sense of whether or not you
respect
them.
What's a better way forward?
I think we need to explore dialogue.
Rather than debate.
I think we need to pay attention to the shortcomings of adversarial ways of dealing with problems. I'm a lawyer, and you know,
that's how the law works, though, isn't it?
It is exactly how it works. But the adversarial system has its limitations. It has its uses, but it also has its limitations. And dialogue is another way of trying to deal with issues. And I think we need to explore that. The Dalai Lama, I interviewed him about this in my book, and he said, you know, we like to think the Western mind is more sophisticated, but in Tibet, we go with the heart. Mm. And he said, I think that's stronger. And so maybe if we take the Western mind and the Tibetan heart together, we can have more success. What we need is more warm-heartedness.
Hear, hear to that. James, good to talk.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.